This is Law and Disorder.
This Friday, Willie Brown, a defendant with a long history of mental illness, is set to be executed in a controversial case.
And the threat to kill him is with lethal injection, which has come under tremendous fire. Doctors won't cooperate with it. So how are they going to kill him?
We'll also have an update on the FBI murder of independentista Filiberto Ojorios.
Since Ojeda's murder, protests have swept Puerto Rico. The government of Puerto Rico itself has attempted to get documents and other information from the United States and the FBI. They've been utterly stonewalled. Hear that and more, and how the U.S. is still attempting to subvert and destroy the Puerto Rican independence movement.
We'll have an update on NSA spying, a story we covered a couple of months ago, and an admission that the NSA may be wiretapping attorneys.
And an astounding admission by the administration that attorneys and calls to their clients, which would include attorneys at the Center for Constitutional Rights, may well have been overheard.
All that and more today on Law and Disorder.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Brown is scheduled to be executed this Friday, April 21st. He was sentenced to death in a 1983 fatal shooting. Brown reportedly has a documented history of mental illness, which the jurors who sentenced him to death did not know about. Brown's current attorneys have described how he received poor legal representation at trial from attorneys who had never before worked on a death penalty case and who failed to present important mitigating evidence to the jury that sentenced him to death. They never contacted family members or friends who were willing to testify on his behalf, and they never showed the jury Brown's documented history of serious mental illness and the fact that he'd been beaten by his father as a child. This Friday, this man will be executed. We are asking everybody who opposes the death penalty and opposes the execution of mentally ill people to go to www.amnestyusa.org, the Amnesty International website. There you can send an appeal to Governor Michael Easley. All the information is right there online. With us today to discuss the impending execution of Willie Brown, the death penalty in general, is Death Penalty Director for Amnesty USA, Sue Gunawardena-Vaughn. Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Sue, this is Michael Smith. I'm here with Heidi Boghossian. Just on a personal note, before we get into the details of the latest public execution on the national scene, but just personally, Sue, how did you yourself become opposed to the death penalty, and why are you opposed to it?
I was an undergraduate, and I was an Amnesty International member, and my faculty advisor was a professor of philosophy who was English and was against the death penalty and really sort of made us aware of some of the things that were going on, and this was in the early 90s. So it was interesting, you know, being in Missouri and trying to figure out that this, in many ways, great country, you know, had this very horrible human rights violation on their hands.
And what do you say to the arguments that it prevents serious crimes, and moreover, it's biblical, it's an eye for an eye, people deserve it, when they commit murder, they should be murdered. How do you respond to that?
Those arguments are sort of facile arguments, because there's a preponderance of evidence that indicates that the death penalty is not a deterrent. I mean, people don't make a, you know, cost-benefit analysis before they commit a murder. You know, if I committed in West Virginia, I'm not eligible for the death penalty. But if I committed in Virginia, I am. I mean, those are not the calculations that go into the mind of someone who's planning to commit some kind of horrendous crime. So the deterrence value is absolutely non-existent. In fact, we find generally an opposite tendency that there's a correlative effect of those states that don't have the death penalty have tend to have less violent crimes than those that do. And
really? Why do you account for that?
Well, I mean, there have been many hypotheses that have been put forward, and one of them is that the death penalty in general has a very brutalizing impact on society. When there's a statement made by the state that human life is so easily extinguishable and can be very clinically taken away, and when we get into the Brown case, I'll talk about how really horrendous this whole machinery of death is. There's a sort of a brutalizing impact on society at all levels.
And yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. Well, tell us about the Willie Brown case. Willie Brown is scheduled to be executed this Friday, April 21st, yeah?
Yes, he's scheduled to be executed in North Carolina for a 1983 murder, which happened during a convenience store robbery. Brown has a documented history of mental illness that was never really brought before the jury. During his first trial, lawyers really didn't use that as mitigating evidence and didn't call any witnesses who could attest to that. Amnesty International.
Why is that?
Well, why is that? There are so many reasons, Dahlia, and I think this show wouldn't probably afford me the time to tell you all the problems that exist within the death penalty. The death penalty is not a fair system on so many different levels. You know, this year, 2006, on July 2nd, we'll be marking the anniversary of Gregg versus Georgia, which was intended to fix the death penalty system in the United States so that it would be fair and equitable. But the fact of the matter is, as we say in our circles, if you have the capital, you don't get the punishment.
And Gregg was a Supreme Court case. Just if you could explain.
Sure.
Your
Gregg, you know, Gregg versus Georgia was a Supreme Court case. The ruling came out in 1976, and it was in reaction to the Thurman versus Georgia case, which in essence imposed a moratorium in 1972. On the death penalty, finding that it didn't abolish the death penalty, but it found state death penalty statutes unconstitutional because they were so erratic.
Arbitrary and capricious?
Arbitrary and capricious, exactly. But the fact of the matter is, if you look at the death penalty system 30 years on, nothing really has changed. In fact, it's even become more capricious and more arbitrary. You can, for example, commit a crime in one state in different jurisdictions and be eligible for the death penalty, depending on whether the prosecutor wants to seek it. Even if you are charged with a death-eligible crime, if you have an excellent defense team, you're not probably going to be found guilty, and you're probably going to be able to plea bargain, and you're probably going to be able to get a life sentence or get a reduced sentence. What we're finding is the death penalty systematically discriminates. It discriminates largely on the basis of socioeconomics. I mean, if you don't have access to competent counsel, as Willie Brown didn't during his trial, you don't have a chance in the system. And there's a correlation, too. There's a systematic bias against people of color, because if you look at the correlative effect of who is at the low end of the socioeconomic sort of scale and then tracking communities of color, they tend to sort of overlap quite a bit. And we find that overwhelmingly on death rows, when you compare it with the general population, I think 40% of death row right now in the United States are people of color.
So you are the expert on this, but my understanding has always been that it is much more than socioeconomics, and race plays a huge factor in it, in that someone who kills a white person is much more likely to get the death penalty than someone who kills a black person.
Well, that was the finding of one of the David Baldus studies,
absolutely,
wasn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I was getting to that. Thank you, Dahlia, for preempting me. I was focusing, first of all, on the perpetrator's race. And what we are finding is, even before we come to the victim, what we are finding out is that, you know, it's a criminal injustice system. This goes way beyond the death penalty. Who gets charged with crimes? Who gets what kinds of crimes they're charged with? How they're taken through the system? These are all, when you look at cases, when you look at the data, far beyond the death penalty. African-American men, there's such bias against them in the system, way beyond the death penalty system, that it is just quite appalling. I don't know what the incarceration rates are of African-American males between the ages of 18 and 34, but it's preponderously high. I mean, it's just beyond the pale. Willie Brown's case, he's had a large documented history of mental illness, which was never, you know, brought to bear with the jury.
So this was a well-documented case of a history of mental illness before trial.
Before trial, for which he never received treatment. I mean, the issues of the death penalty also go beyond just the criminal justice system. It impacts, you know, victims, how we deal with victims, how we deal with health care, how we deal with mental health care, how we deal with education, juvenile justice. I mean, it's a whole plethora of issues. When we work on the death penalty, we see the tail end of everything society has done wrong, and every mistake society has done wrong comes to rest with the execution. And, you know, you can almost do a sort of a tracing back of a case history and think, at this point, things could have been changed. At this point, things could have been changed, and nothing was done.
So let's talk about Willie Brown. Willie Brown had a well-documented case of history of mental illness before trial, and yet at trial, none of that evidence was admitted.
No, his attorneys did not present any of this as a mitigating factor.
This was a court-appointed attorney?
Was a court-appointed attorney, because his attorneys now are different and are, you know, very committed, working very hard to avert this execution. But the other thing that's really important is Brown's jurors were given improper instructions that they had to unanimously agree on mitigating circumstances. And this was later actually ruled as unconstitutional by the U.S. Supreme Court.
And what does it mean that the jury has to unanimously agree on mitigating circumstances?
Well, what it means is that if one person said, for example, you know, I think the fact that Mr. Brown has had a serious case of mental illness, really, I don't feel comfortable making the argument for death because of this thing. And nine other people said, no, we think that he should go ahead and be executed no matter what his mental illness. The jurors were given the instructions that all of them had to agree.
So can we explain to listeners about aggravating and mitigating circumstances under our system of what is called guided discretion?
Sure.
To aid jurors in making their decision?
Sure.
Those are two of the factors.
It's very interesting because in the case of mental illness, one of the issues that we see is mental illness is which should really be used as a mitigating factor. Mitigating means the punishment is lessened because of certain factors, whether it's severe child abuse, whether it's mental illness, whether, you know, there were
human factors
that maybe reduces the culpability of someone who committed this crime in a fit of passion or under some delusional psychotic state or what have you. And an aggravating factor is something that it makes the heinousness of the crime even more. Say, for example, someone killed, you know, five people very brutally, showed no remorse. There were other issues. There was rape involved, you know, there was future dangerousness involved. That would be considered an aggravating factor. So generally, but what we are finding with mental illness, unfortunately, is that many prosecutors are using mental illness as not the defense attorneys, but the prosecutors are using the fact that someone has mental illness as an aggravating factor, saying, look, this person is really dangerous. You know, you can't let them back in society because they'll commit this.
That's what they're doing right now in the Zacharias Moussaoui trial.
Exactly.
Well,
that's
because future dangerousness is, in fact, considered on some list an aggravator. Is there new evidence, though, coming out that, in fact, this is not a painless procedure, that it can be excruciatingly painful?
There have been numerous documented cases of botched lethal injection. Now the issues, though, really sort of focus on the medical ethics of all of this. As you know, in California a few months ago, Michael Morales, when they were about to literally, you know, put the needle in his veins, the two anesthesiologists walked out because they just didn't feel comfortable.
It's a similar issue that we see in Guantanamo that we've talked on our show earlier, with doctors being forced to participate in the torture of people, mm-hmm. and seeing psychologically how to break someone, psychologically how to make someone absolutely desperate in the worst possible situation, or to determine how much physical pain and torture a body can take before that person actually dies. This is completely contrary to what we train doctors to do.
But isn't the issue at hand now that judges, in response to this evidence, are actually insisting that doctors directly supervise executions against the AMA's code of ethics?
What happened in the California case and what's happening in Willie Brown's case is both these federal judges have said there needs to be a stay of execution until the state can revise its lethal injection protocol by ensuring the person who's going to be executed and who's going to receive the lethal injection is fully sedated and unconscious.
We've been talking with Sue Ganawardenavon from Amnesty International's USA program, the director of the Anti-Death Penalty Program. Sue, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Sue.
Thank you very much for having me.
We just heard from Sue Ganawardenavon, director of the Program to Abolish the Death Penalty at Amnesty International USA. During our talk, we referenced how the death penalty is implemented in this country, and we didn't really talk too specifically about the statutes that differ from state to state. After Furman, the case we discussed, states came up with sentencing schemes designed to make it easier for death penalty jurors to understand how to implement this complicated decision.
When you say death penalty jurors, you mean jurors who are sitting on a case after there's been a conviction, and then there's a separate phase of the trial,
right,
which they call the death penalty,
right,
phase.
It's a bifurcated system.
And there's and each state then puts a statute in that tries to comply with the Supreme Court decision.
Exactly. And so one of the things we discussed earlier was aggravating and mitigating circumstances. They're actually given a list of things to look at, to weigh in those categories. And the systems are complex and confusing because it's designed both to individualize the defendant in the eyes of the jurors so that they can consider life factors that might explain
like
why
if he was beaten as a child,
exactly,
that would be a mitigation.
Exactly, or abandoned, whatever.
And But an aggravating factor would be what kinds of things would aggravate?
Well, one of the things is future dangerousness. Is he likely to repeat the crime? One of the things is the heinousness of the crime.
Oh, they actually bring that back?
They bring it in some of them, the heinousness.
Like after he killed the person, if he then kicked their head around.
If he tortured, if there was rape involved, right, if there was felonies. I've been doing some research, and because I've been interested in work that the Capital Jury Project and the National Science Foundation have done that show in the 1990s, they did lots of studies in Indiana and showed that these systems, which are called guided sentencing schemes, are actually biased in favor of the jurors calling for death. Some of the reasons are that the jurors feel they're only advising that their decision may be reviewable. And, for example, in Mumia Abu-Jamal's case and some other cases, the prosecutor has actually said, your decision is not final. There can be appeal after appeal, and that's been held to lessen the juror's sense of responsibility.
Sure.
And that's been held to be unconstitutional,
right,
in Caldwell v.
Mississippi.
Right,
that's clearly unconstitutional. If you can, and it haven't came up in a recent case, again, in the Supreme Court, I think. Right, it's clearly
exactly
illegal, right?
And the rules are confusing, and jurors often aren't even told that they have the possibility of imposing life without parole. Many states don't allow that to come in, so they feel the person's either going to get a lesser sentence or has to be killed. So the flaws that resulted in the death penalty being held unconstitutional 30 years ago are still ripe in this system. And one of the things in this current case is the fact that they will now be rendering unconscious the defendant while he or she is actually being administered the lethal injection.
Wait, then let me go back to two things. One, we were discussing about the factors first that are making the death penalty more likely than not,
right,
in these cases. And, of course, you also have the issue that people are death qualified. Did you mention that?
No, we didn't.
Okay, what happens when you sit on a jury in a death penalty case, if you have scruples or consciousness or religious views about that people shouldn't be given the death penalty, you're excluded from the jury. So that you automatically get on the people on the jury
who already
say, well, yeah, I think the death penalty is an appropriate punishment for the kinds of cases we have.
Yeah.
So you're talking about essentially a mass population, and you're talking about a funnel that keeps funneling people down until by the end you're getting people who favor the death penalty, and then you're getting a series of factors that actually
hit them over the head and say, give this guy the death penalty.
Right.
And then you get to how you actually carry out the death penalty. Which
and
is,
that's what we're dealing with here. That lethal injection, most people thought was so-called humane means rather than electrocution.
They, in Utah, they used hanging and they used cyanide gas. You sit in a room and you're sitting in a chair. And
they still use?
I don't know if they do it anymore. Yeah. Up until a few years ago, and you sit in a chair and they have a pool of acid under you and then some kind of thing is dropped into it.
The pellets.
And the cyanide gas goes up and you slowly sit there and breathe.
So lethal injection.
Utah was the state that had the firing squad not that long ago.
Right.
That's how they executed Joe Hill in Utah.
Right. And didn't Mailer write a book about an execution there? Remember? It was famous. He watched the execution of a friend of his. Or not a friend, a guy who became
friends.
Yeah. Okay, now this issue. Yeah.
The Willie Brown issue is bringing up actually two issues. One is that lethal injection is not painless, as we had been told, so that what they're going to do is render Willie unconscious.
And how do they do that?
They inject something to keep him unconscious.
They have a doctor.
And that's the second issue, is that against the American Medical Association's code of ethics, they are requiring doctors to be on hand to administer what he needs to be kept unconscious if he wakes up.
Because the first rule in the code of ethics is first do no harm.
Well, the judges have ordered the death penalty to only be carried out under the supervision of doctors.
Right.
But doctors now, the rule of the AMA and whatever it is, maybe not the AMA, but the doctors code is they can't do this.
Right.
So now they've tried to actually carry out a number of executions, and they've been unable to do them because no doctor will show up. And Willie Brown, apparently, is a major test case of this in North Carolina.
Right. We will know any day now what's going to happen in that case.
Well, they don't know what they're going to do, actually. I mean, I'm not sure he's going to be able to be executed right now.
Remember Clinton's groundbreaking move in that respect when he was on the campaign trail, and they were executing Ricky Ray Clinton's home state of Arkansas. And Clinton broke off from campaigning to go back to Arkansas
to
preside over this guy's execution. And this guy was so mentally defective.
Yeah.
When they asked him what he wanted for his last meal, he told him, among other things, he wanted a hot fudge sundae, but he says, serve that to me afterwards.
Yeah.
Right. There was an amazing article on that guy in New Yorker that just tore Clinton to pieces.
Yeah.
One of Clinton's close friends, a guy who knew Clinton back in Arkansas, was the lawyer for the guy. And at the last minute, he tried to get even Clinton to respond to a phone call, and Clinton wouldn't even recognize it. Clinton understood that pulling that lever to electrocute that guy was basically pulling in probably a million votes or more.
Yeah, got him into office, so he's willing to do it.
In his view.
And his wife's no different, I should mention. I remember, Michael, when your daughter, Anna, who's 16 now, and she was around 6 or 7 years old when it happened, was a reporter for her grade school newspaper. And she was actually invited because her friend's parents were having a fundraiser for Hillary Clinton. And Anna went to the fundraising party as a reporter for the Little Red newspaper. It was Anna, then age 7, cornered Hillary Clinton and put it to her about the death penalty, and then wrote quite a good article in the Little Red grade school newspaper about how she opposed Hillary Clinton because Hillary Clinton was for the death penalty. That's more than I can say for most reporters on the New York Times.
If you enjoyed this segment, we encourage you to check out our blog, lawanddisorder.org, and let us know what you're thinking.
Last week, Dahlia Hashad was on the program and described what happened to her in a Texas restaurant and the incredible discrimination she was at the end of in terms of trying to get served at the restaurant. It was a moving and quite impassioned talk that we had with Dahlia, and we received from that talk on the air incredibly moving statements from people who had similar experience, were sympathetic with Dahlia. That's important to all of us because we want to hear feedback. We want to be able to see what touches our listeners. And so we really want to encourage you to use the blog at lawanddisorder.org. For a while now, the hosts of this program have been talking about a new TV show that's going to be on PBS called The Armenian Genocide. And one of our hosts, Heidi Boghossian, is actually Armenian and has been very, very concerned by this issue. We can bring our listeners up to date on where that is. But today, actually, and tonight, they will be showing on PBS stations the documentary, The Armenian Genocide. It's particularly significant because, of course, the Turks, Turkey, has denied that there was such a genocide and denied that there was mass killing of Armenians. The controversy has come up because some of the PBS stations are going to be playing a wrapping the genocide movie into a panel that occurs afterwards. And on that panel, there's going to be at least two people, it appears, who are what you would call genocide or Armenian genocide deniers. Now, when Heidi and I talk about that, I'm interested in your reaction, Heidi. I can imagine if you did a program on the Holocaust, a one-hour program on the Holocaust, and on a panel afterwards, you put two Holocaust deniers. Do you think that program would be put on any station in the United States?
Of course not. But one of the problems is that this country refuses to deny. They won't acknowledge in the textbooks. They won't acknowledge on
Turkey
paper.
Won't.
Well, and also this country won't
US
acknowledge
won't
it.
No,
our
the United States sides,
don't talk
sides
about
with Turkey.
Exactly.
They can't. Turkey, of course, denies it. The ones that did it, Turkish Muslims did it to the Armenian Christians on the basis that they were fifth columnists during the First World War. Turkey has never owned up to it. The United States, because it's an ally of Turkey, a military ally, supports Turkey in that. The most cruel thing of all is that denying the genocide is really the ultimate act of genocide, isn't it?
It is. And when I was little, I would ask questions about it because we didn't talk about it much in my household, and that's not that uncommon for sons and daughters. My father's parents came over. My grandmother was actually a mail order bride, and her family was massacred. And what they would do is the Turks would walk the Armenians out into the desert and starve them. The women would be raped. They would be slaughtered. And I would ask why no one knows who Armenians are. I go to school. They say, "What are you?" I'd say, "Armenian." They're like, "Who's that?" Although they'd heard the phrase, "Remember the starving Armenians." I said to my mother, why don't more people know about this? And she said, well, because our textbooks don't acknowledge it, because our government is friends with Turkey, and we have a relationship with them that we don't want to sacrifice. But I was delighted to hear about this documentary, but then really saddened to hear that there would be a panel with the deniers on it. And luckily, there was a huge outpouring. I think there were over 8,000 emails and letters from Armenian Americans and others around the country to PBS asking that they not air the panel. And apparently what's happened is the panel will be carried by about 50 local affiliates.
Yeah, but none of the major cities out in the boondocks, but the major cities backed off from perpetuating this lie.
Now, what year did the did the genocide
It was in
place?
The beginning of the century. I think 1924 was 1 year, and then a few years earlier. It came in two waves.
Yeah, during the First World War.
Yeah.
It's amazing the passion here, because it says in an article I'm reading that the filmmaker, Andrew Goldberg, he has said because he's afraid of the partisan protest, he's actually had to hire off-duty police officers for security because of the documentary at a Los Angeles movie house. Then you have others. In Turkey, one of the professors involved in the film said he faced death threats when he spoke out in a Turkish newspaper about the genocide.
It's a volatile issue and means a lot to the Armenians. Michael, you were telling me a few months ago, I think there was a human rights conference that Armenians wanted to hold in Turkey a few times, and it had to be postponed. There was so much resistance in Turkey, but I think finally it did happen. So the good news is that Peter Balakian, the author, has written a couple of books. The Black Dog was one.
Yeah.
A lot of people are speaking out more about the history of the Armenians, which is a good thing. And I think this most recent effort shows that people are immediately outraged and will express their views.
Now, I think that the whole question of human solidarity here is eventually going to win out, and we're going to get this public.
Well, we urge viewers to watch the documentary tonight, PBS, at I think 9 p.m.
Yes, this is the ghetto. Shown up now. Oh,
Our next guest will be Charlie Haymaestre. Charlie Haymaestre is a civil rights attorney in Puerto Rico and a board member of the Center for Constitutional Rights. He has been working around the case, the murder of Filiberto Ojeda. He's part of the investigative team investigating the murder and is current on the situation in Puerto Rico. Since that murder, the situation has been deteriorating in Puerto Rico. There has been serious protests against the FBI about the murder. There has been government investigations by the government of Puerto Rico to try and get to the bottom of it. But so far, there has been incredible obstruction by both the U.S. Justice Department and the FBI. And in fact, the Puerto Rican government has accused the FBI and the U.S. Justice Department of actually obstructing the investigation. Things deteriorated to such an extent that the Puerto Rican justice minister went to court to sue the United States to get information because the United States wouldn't even give up the names of the agents involved in the killing of Filiberto Ojeda. So now we're going to hear a firsthand report from Charlie Haymaestre about the continued repression in Puerto Rico, particularly sparked by the murder of Filiberto Ojeda.
Charlie Haymaestre, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hi.
We had a discussion with Attorney Linda Bacchiel 3 months ago after the FBI murder of Filiberto, and I understand things have really proceeded apace since then. We're very happy to have you on the show to get an update about what's going on in the island. Can you give us, in a nutshell, some of the highlights of the mobilizations and what's been done with the FBI?
Okay, well, first of all, there are things going on several fronts. First of all, there's two official investigations which are being allegedly carried out, at least by separate government agencies. The Inspector General's office is carrying out an internal investigation of FBI actions on that date. We're talking about what occurred on September 23rd.
Yeah, Charlie, why don't you just, in a little capsule, bring the listeners up to date on, remind them of what happened,
okay,
actually.
On September 23rd, 2005, FBI, with the support of the Puerto Rico police, I should add, carried out a huge operation in a small mountain town of Hormigueros. This is on the southwest coast of Puerto Rico. Total population of about 18,000 people, and in a rural area of that town, where they identified that Filiberto Ojeda Ríos, who is one of the leading independence leaders and advocates here in Puerto Rico in over the past 50, 60 years, was in hiding. Filiberto had been living underground, essentially, over the last about 15, 20 years. Although underground is a relative term, because, in fact, he was living amongst the community and regularly communicated with the press, issued press releases on a number of issues, issued papers, and commented on the issues of the day. So he was very present in the public discourse in Puerto Rico. Now, what the FBI did was they acted on a long outstanding arrest warrant, identified where he was, and instead of arresting him, came in with a huge show of force. We're talking about dozens and dozens of officers, helicopters. They cordoned off a huge community. At least 100 families were cordoned off, shut down the electricity, shut off all communication between that area of the town and the outside world, essentially carried out a sort of a Waco-type siege, where the result was that Filiberto Ojeda, who was a 72-year-old man living just with his wife, was killed by the agents. And I'm going to leap forward quickly, but what we all suspected was true was confirmed by the Puerto Rico Secretary of Justice, who's our Attorney General, who spoke at Congress at a congressional hearing this week and said that the autopsy reflects that had Filiberto Ojeda received medical attention promptly, he would not have bled to death, which is what happened. So that's part of what's going on here.
And he was left to die in his home.
He was left to die. He was shot several times, and he bled to death.
Have the FBI done anything else against the independence movement since the assassination?
There is an investigation going on being carried out by the Secretary of Justice of Puerto Rico, who has been frustrated in his efforts to get the information from the FBI. In fact, he hasn't been able even to get the names of the agents who participated and has gone to court here in San Juan, filed an action in the Puerto Rico District Court for the U.S. District of Puerto Rico, the U.S. Federal Court, and was essentially thrown out of court by the judge. And the judges here tend to be extremely hostile to any attacks on federal authority. And that's actually what happened to him. So he's turned to Congress to try to get congressional support for the FBI to turn over information. That is not moving too quickly, but that is on the front burner. The other thing that's going on is that the Puerto Rico Bar Association, which is one of the oldest civil society institutions in Puerto Rico has convened a commission to investigate this independently of the government, the two government entities. I am on that commission. It is headed by Selena Romani, a former member of the board of CCR in New York. And this commission, we carried out hearings, 2 days of public hearings in Hormigueros. We received testimony from the mayor and the police chief of the town, who talked about the fact that they were never contacted, never informed at all about the FBI operation, that they understand from their perspective that the operation was totally illegal, unwarranted, and unjustifiable. We talked with many, many members of the community, people who suffered extreme duress during this period, children that were hiding under beds because there were helicopters flying around, people dropping out of the helicopters. It was a commando action. It was literally a mini war, those hours that it went on.
And how many hours did it go on?
The community was isolated about 3 o'clock in the afternoon of the 23rd, wasn't reopened to the public until Sunday afternoon, Sunday midday.
The FBI hasn't let up on its repression either,
not
has it?
Not at all, not at all. And what occurred was the 10th of February. The FBI carried out a number of searches around the island of Puerto Rico, some here in San Juan, some on the south coast, others on the west coast, of homes and offices of known independence advocates with warrants that were signed, you know, issued by the local U.S. District Court, but in a manner of such hostility and abuse and a show of force that I think is rarely seen in the United States. What occurred in particular at one of the homes here, which was searched, was that the press immediately, you know, gathered, and as did many people from the community when the FBI were carrying this raid out. The press were the most recent victims of the FBI as they tried to do their job and as they tried to get information, tried to interview the FBI officers. They were literally shoved and pepper sprayed. All of this is on film and in pictures that have been, you can get them down off the internet, but essentially they were attacked by the FBI, who refused to answer questions, refused to let them cover the story, and several of them suffered considerable injuries.
And I understand that there were a number of meetings of independistas organized about the island, and the FBI is trying to suppress those too.
Absolutely. I mean, people have been followed, people have been surveilled at a level not seen in recent years.
Why this sudden crackdown?
Well, there are many theories about that, and that's an excellent question. What's curious is that in the late 90s and into the early part of this century, the first few years, 2000, 2001, 2002, the FBI had been involved in trying to crack down on certain corruption in Puerto Rico, government corruption. And in fact, there were many arrests and many prosecutions, and there were actually over two dozen former members of the pro-statehood government of the late 90s who are now in jail for various corruption convictions. Suddenly, after 2001, the Patriot Act, etc., there is a shift from dealing with government corruption to we have to fight domestic terrorism. And in fact, the FBI issued, after this most recent round of searches in all these homes and offices that I described, they attempted to justify or explain their actions, saying that they were investigating, quote, domestic terrorism, unquote, which people in Puerto Rico overwhelmingly reject is a pretext. I mean, very few people believe that it's legitimate.
I want to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Charlie A. Maestra, who is a member of the board of the Center for Constitutional Rights. He practices law in San Juan, Puerto Rico, and we're getting an update on the FBI repression that's going on the island now. I'm getting a sinking feeling, Charlie, as we speak, that what's happening to people down there could be happening to people up here next.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, simultaneously, for sure. It's very frightening because essentially what's going on is a shift in the use of this apparatus of the federal government to quell dissent and to use the boogeyman of terrorism to persecute political minorities. That tactic will be transferable to many organizations, and we've seen what's happened with, you know, warrantless searches, electronic searches in the States, which is really on the front burner of the ongoing debate about whether that's legal. Well, this is another aspect of the same tactic.
Now, Charlie, if people want to get more information on Ojeda's case and what the current situation is in Puerto Rico, is there a website they can go to?
For those who are bilingual, I would certainly have you visit the website of claridadpuertorico.org, which is the progressive weekly newspaper, which will cover a lot of stuff, as will ND.com, which is the main daily newspaper. It's El Nuevo Día.
Charlie, we'll put up a link on our website to Clary Dodd. We want to thank you for being on Law and Disorder. Charlie A. Maestra, Puerto Rican civil rights attorney. So good to have you on the show.
It's a pleasure, and thanks for the opportunity to share this information.
You take it easy.
Bye, Charlie.
Bye-bye now.
Our next guest is from the Center for Constitutional Rights, Shane K. Dedal. Shane is an attorney at the center, and he's the chief lawyer on the Center for Constitutional Rights lawsuit against the president for doing and engaging in warrantless wiretapping outside of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court and outside of the Fourth Amendment. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Shane.
Well, thank you, Michael, for having me.
Shane, first I want you to bring us up to date on where the Center for Constitutional Rights suit is, what its allegations were, and some of the recent events that have happened on the warrantless wiretapping issue.
Sure. Well, the New York Times broke the story about this warrantless wiretapping program the NSA was carrying out in the middle of December of last year. And so within a month, we managed to get our lawsuit filed right after the Martin Luther King holidays. The government usually gets 2 months to respond to any lawsuit you file, and we expected, you know, that they would respond by filing a motion to dismiss, saying the subject matter of this suit is so sensitive that we can't even allow the lawsuit to go forward, even with, you know, sort of the usual protections of filing documents under seal and only letting the court look at it. Now, we, in response to that sort of affected defense that everything was too secret, what we did was went through all the public statements that the administration had made and picked out the things that they had said about the nature of the program to show that really what they were doing should have been covered by FISA and that they should have sought warrants under that statute to do the spying that they were doing. You know, we felt those facts they'd already admitted to proved enough that we didn't even have to have a trial in the case, that the court could give us a victorious judgment just based on things the defendants had admitted to publicly that the government had said in press conferences.
Now, in our case, we're alleging that attorneys at the center are being overheard on these wiretaps. Is that right?
That's right. You know, obviously, it's a secret wiretapping program, and so nobody has any, you know, real hard documentary evidence out there that they were subjects of the wiretapping, with a few limited exceptions. And we certainly don't have any hard documentary evidence right now that we were targets of this. But, you know, the Attorney General, in his first press conference on this program, said, you know, look, we are targeting this program at people who are members of Al-Qaeda or affiliated with Al-Qaeda or just affiliated somehow with groups that are involved with terrorism. And the administration has basically said in a whole number of other lawsuits that we've brought that our clients are exactly that type of person, someone affiliated with terrorism. So, for instance, we represent several hundred detainees at Guantanamo. We represent all the immigration detainees who were swept up right after 9/11 and labeled as of interest to the terrorism investigation solely because they were Muslim. And then we represent Maher Arar, a Canadian citizen who was pulled off his connection at JFK Airport, interrogated for 12 days, and then sent not to Canada, the country of his citizenship, but rather to Syria for 10 months of torture at the behest of the United States.
Shane, can you give us an idea of how many attorneys at the center might be the subject of the monitoring?
Almost everybody here engages in international phone calls and emails with people who the administration suspects at some level of involvement with terrorism or sort of groups that are thought to have some involvement with terrorism.
So, Shane, just to play devil's advocate, so what's wrong with that? Protecting us, right?
Yeah, it's not the idea that the government would be listening in on conversations of people who have an involvement with terrorism that's problematic. It's the way that they've gone about doing it. The Congress has set up a statute, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, that is supposed to really occupy the entire field of wiretapping. You know, it says that the statute and another statute are supposed to be the exclusive means by which the president can carry out electronic surveillance. And it's easy enough for the president to go to a FISA court and say, look, this is why we want to wiretap a certain person overseas. It's because we have this proof that they are involved with terrorism or with an organization that supports terrorism. If the president doesn't have any proof at all that somebody is affiliated with terrorism, but just has some, you know, sort of prejudicial reason for thinking that they're worthy of being eavesdropped upon, like the fact that they're Muslim, you know, that's not enough.
Shane, even in that case, if the person, let's say they got an alleged Al-Qaeda guy over there and we happen to be his attorney for purposes of trying to get him a writ of habeas corpus or his family, he's in Guantanamo and we're talking to his family, they still can't listen in on our attorney-client
calls.
Even if they got a warrant. So even if they went to a warrant, they couldn't
right.
do that.
I mean, yeah, one of the reasons that, you know, everything is supposed to go through a judge is not just so that you have an independent referee to kind of weigh the evidence and decide whether someone's worthy of being a target of surveillance. It's also to put in place what are called minimization procedures. Now, if you're doing a domestic wiretap, for instance, on someone, if they're having a privileged phone call, meaning, you know, say a phone call with one of their attorneys, there are all sorts of rules that are built in and have been kind of well established over the last 30 or 40 years about, you know, the way that, that law enforcement is supposed to deal with that. You know, typically they're supposed to kind of turn off the recorders, and occasionally they can pop in and out of the calls, sort of get a sense for whether or not any criminal activity is being discussed. But for the most part, they're supposed to take a lot of protective measures to make sure that privileged conversations don't get overheard. And if the president goes entirely around the system that FISA sets up for getting warrants, you know, to spy on terrorists, then, you know, one of the things that that allows him to do is listen in on attorney-client communication.
And what's wrong with that?
Surveilling attorney-client communications intimidates potential clients out there, and thus it makes it less likely the challenges to this administration's illegal conduct are ever going to be brought in court.
Well, what are the reasons for having a privilege that an attorney can talk to his client, you know, just going back to basics?
You know, I mean, there are a number of reasons. In the criminal defense context, it's this notion that that you ought to be able to prepare an aggressive defense. And so, you know, there may be situations, you know, I don't know, where someone's discussing other criminal conduct that isn't the subject of the particular charge at issue, and that they need to sort of get the lawyer up to speed on that so that they know how to distinguish it.
And also that you're innocent until proven guilty.
Sure.
And Shane, doesn't it also affect how the attorney talks to his or her client? Has this affected how you and others speak with people on the phone?
Well, sure. It's had a great deal of effect on that. And also, you know, not just phone, but email, which is something that we use quite a bit with people internationally. We don't want to get too much into detail about the actual practices that we're undertaking because there's some questions of privilege involved there. But, you know, look, I mean, you could hypothetically imagine that if we were talking to a client about something sensitive, there may be certain circumstances where instead of just picking up the phone and calling them, we might want to actually schedule a trip to go fly out there and talk to them in person, under circumstances where, you know, there was no risk of electronic surveillance. And so not only do we have to bear the expense of traveling and the hassle of traveling, but it also means we have to delay those communications for a couple of weeks. And if it's a conversation that we need to have in order to file for some relief in court, it means it's going to put off ever being able to get that relief for a couple of weeks.
I want to get to the point of the recent revelation. So here we have the Center for Constitutional Rights lawsuit claiming that the government is listening in on our calls and or monitoring our email with our clients all over the world who fit the category of people they've been doing warrantless wiretapping. And then the Senate asks the executive president a series of questions about what they're doing and what this program's about. And I think one of those was actually quite revealing. Do you want to talk about that a little?
Sure. Well, the Democrat on the Senate committees asked a number of questions, about 40 of them, I think, to the government, trying to get some more answers, more detail about the nature of this surveillance program. And the government sent back a 15-page response to these 40-odd questions. And they sent it out on Friday evening, which, you know, for people who aren't involved in controversial lawsuits, the significance of that is that newspapers don't really cover anything that goes out on Friday evening. So it's a way of burying important stories by releasing information late in the day on Friday. But responses are very interesting. About the first 14 pages were really, you know, in the nature of, look, we can't tell you any answers to this because the program is so secret that we can't reveal anything about the way it works. But when they got to the very last question, which was, have any conversations of attorneys with clients been eavesdropped upon under the NSA program and other sort of privileged conversations like doctors with patients? What the answer was not, we can't tell you because it's too secret. They said, we can't categorically rule out that these sort of conversations have been listened in on. To my mind, that's basically, you know, sort of an admission by denial. They're really kind of laying the groundwork for later on revealing that a lot of attorney-client communications were eavesdropped upon. I can't imagine any other reason. You know,
yeah, I agree with that. I was really floored when I read it in the Saturday Times, essentially read it the way you did, Shane, that this was really admitting that a lot of these phone calls are going to be picking up attorneys and, you know, of all the set of attorneys they're going to really be picking up, of course, it's the attorneys at the Center for Constitutional Rights and probably a lot of the Guantanamo attorneys that we work with in representing Guantanamo
right.
detainees.
And it makes perfect sense because, look, FISA is a very easy route for the administration to go through. Out of the last 18,800 applications that have been made since the FISA statute was passed, only five applications by the government have ever been rejected. So, you know, you have to ask yourself, why would the government go around it through this NSA program if they were really just trying to target terrorists? And I think one explanation is that they are, you know, eavesdropping on the type of conversations that even a very conservative FISA court judge would never approve of. You know, conversations of attorneys with their clients or conversations of journalists with their confidential sources overseas. And if that's the case, you know, it's you know, it's certainly an explanation for why they went around the FISA statute. It's also probably an impeachable offense.
Shane, have you been following the hearings on Friday?
Just a little bit. The news coverage so far has actually made them sound, sound like they were actually relatively substantive. You know, John Dean got up there and testified, and a few Republican senators attacked him. You know, one of the things he said was that, you know, gee, maybe Nixon would have not gone as far with his abuses if he had been censured early on.
Yeah, these are hearings now on the Feingold censure resolution. And the Feingold censure resolution is about particularly warrantless wiretapping that the president is engaging in. So, Shane, thank you very, very much. And keep up the terrific work.
Bye, Shane.
Thanks a lot, Shane.
Okay. You've been listening to Shane Katedel from the Center for Constitutional Rights, who is the attorney for the center in its case against President Bush regarding warrantless wiretapping. One other reference I'd like to bring people to is to go to the CCR website. That's ccr-ny.org, ccr-ny.org. There's an article that was just published on Friday on there by Michael Ratner, that's me, and Sarah Miles. And it particularly takes up the issue of warrantless wiretapping and particularly the wiretapping of attorneys and attorney-client conversations. Again, it's ccr-ny.org. It's in the Salon magazine. That's salon.org. You can get it there as well. But it is linked on the website of the center. It's an article, again, about warrantless wiretapping and the wiretapping of attorney-client conversations. That was Shane Katedel, Center for Constitutional Rights attorney, who is one of the attorneys handling the center's case challenging the National Security Agency and the president for its warrantless wiretapping. There are other cases out there as well as the center's case, and one of the most significant of those cases is brought by the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is a nonprofit that litigates issues particularly concerning electronics, the internet, basically new technologies types of issues. Interestingly, they brought their case at Electronic Frontier Foundation against AT&T, the big telephone company that has switches all over the United States. And those switches are where your internet traffic as well as your phone calls go through, both for switching within the United States as well as for switching outside the United States. And what the EFF lawsuit contends is that AT&T unlawfully has allowed the National Security Agency to put its computers, monitors, whatever kind of machinery they have, onto AT&T's switches. And what those computers can do is they can monitor millions, in fact, billions of emails and phone calls and monitor them for keywords. So if the word terrorist is in there, if the word Libya is in there, for example, if the word Iraq is in there, it can pick up that email, spit it out, and send it over to whatever appropriate agency it wants to. And what EFF contends is that that's being done by EFF, Electronic Frontier Foundation, that's being done by AT&T. Now, there's been an amazing development in that case, which is that there's actually proof that AT&T has done this. And some of that proof was given to the judge by Electronic Frontier Foundation. And then along came the U.S. government and said, you can't do this. We want all the documents. We want them all back. And we don't want them exposed to the public. We want them all sealed. And so there's a big fight going on about even getting this information out.
Michael, wasn't there a big break in this case when a former AT&T technician actually came forward with proof that they had been secretly and unlawfully monitoring?
That's
networks.
Correct. There was an AT&T technician who was not directly involved in it, but he said when you were walking around the offices, it was obvious. People were talking about it, and he wondered about it, and he eventually came forward, and he's actually a major witness saying, this is going on. It's bad enough if it was about a few phone calls made from people in the United States to alleged terrorists overseas, or wherever the United States considers them. But this looks to us like this is a massive surveillance program that may cover millions of phone calls and emails in the United States.
Few things that this whistleblower said, and one of them was that based on his understanding of the connections and equipment at issue, it definitely appeared that the NSA is capable of conducting what he calls vacuum cleaner surveillance of all the data crossing the internet, either people's email, web surfing, or any other data.
If you have a word in there they want to pick up, a name they want to pick up, any other identifier, a country they want to pick up, they're picking it up. So if you want to talk about Orwellian Big Brother coming home, you don't have to go any other distance. This is it. We're using the highest level technology. The U.S. is using the highest level technology to make sure that every single email you send may be monitored and spit out and given to the government.
Be careful what you write.
Be careful what you say.
Be careful when you use your cell phone.
But don't be careful protesting. Get out there and do it.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. Law and Disorder is produced by Jeff Brady. The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.